Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen.
And Brian Manatee, writer, Brushwood.
I wouldn't ride a manatee. That'd be a violation, subject to a $500 fine or more.
Oh, $500 to ride?
Or more, much more.
Well, gentlemen, before we get into that and who may or may not have ridden it in, you know, a threatened species, I forget what their status is.
Endangered, possibly moving to threatened.
Wait, does it go threatened and endangered? Which way does it go?
Threatened is the more populous. And it's kind of funny because just gossiping with folks, it's like why are there not more rules about encountering these beasts? And they're all like, well, I mean, you know, people live here, and they're like, what are you going to tell me I can't swim in my own backyard? I don't, you know, it's not my fault there are manatees there. And then and then it's like, well, I guess the answer is there should be so many manatees that nobody cares if you ride them. You know,
exactly.
They should be like sea cows should be like cows now, basically.
Yeah, I think, you know, we found that actually can help, like in like repopulating tigers. Tiger farms help.
Yeah,
well, the other white meat.
I may have loudly proclaimed like, yeah, there should be so many we should eat them, right? Yeah. not the most popular joke there.
Even if it makes sense. Before we get to that, I want to talk about another threatened species. An endangered species. And that is humanity.
Oh, no. That's the other manatee.
The other white meat.
Yeah. So some scientists doing their science thing were playing around with some Judean jar handles. You know, they had these jar handles from Judea. And they're like, hey, guys, you know, these things can record magnetic fields. Wouldn't it be fun for just giggles if we found out if like magnetic fields had fluctuated throughout history, which we know happens on some level. We know that this takes place. So they decided to go use their science to go look at these jar handles from the 8th to the 2nd century and examine them. And what they noticed, which was very interesting, was they saw what looked like magnetic spikes, periods in which the Earth's magnetic field increased its intensity dramatically, so much so that if it happened today, it could do things like fry our electrical grid and kind of make life really suck.
All right, hold on. I'm going back to my high school science here. And if I remember correctly, like the evidence for magnetic poles shifting was in various rock strata because, you know, we have a North Pole and a South Pole, and every so often things get a little soft and then they just loop, loop, and then they flip sides. And I remember there being pottery samples because mixed in with all that stuff was ferrous material that would align itself north-south as it was mixed and moved to a line, and then it got fired and got locked in. And they would say, okay, this is when the South Pole went south and when the North Pole went south and everything up and down. But if I'm hearing you correctly, the new news is that they're able to gauge the intensity of essentially magnetic flares during that time, not just pole shifting?
So, one, let's back up. One, I don't think that we've had an example of a pole flipping in human history. I'm not sure, but I'm pretty – I don't think we've had that happen.
Okay,
but
that must be various geological samples I was thinking.
Yeah.
Clay.
What this is, it's not solar, but it's the Earth's magnetic field. Or pardon me as I hit my microphone, so excited here. The Earth's own magnetic field inside, because we've got this strange, and we still don't quite know how it happens. We know there's like molten iron in the core rotating these convection currents. So we think that there might be some sort of event that can take place where they will spike just from the Earth internally. Things will happen.
Okay, so you're saying, okay, so what I need to do is this is a similar type of evidence to the idea of magnetic poles flipping, but it has nothing to do with the poles flipping. Instead, you're saying, just as we already know that a solar flare can fry a bunch of electronics if they're not properly shielded, or as the book 1 Minute After postulated, a EMP blast could knock out all of our electronics, we have a new source to be afraid of. of energy that can blast out our electronics.
That is correct, sir. Now, ready for it to get even weirder, because I was fascinated by the subject and I came across something that I had, you know, you hear about, you know, or something you then you sort of go, okay, whatever. Do you know about the South Atlantic anomaly?
Yes, it's the number one cruise ship attraction from 2012 to 2014.
If you want any more proof that the Earth's magnetic field is a little bit wonky and weird, is that the Earth's magnetic field isn't this perfectly spherical or donut shaped thing. There is a place in the South Atlantic where it is a varying intensity, which means that the Van Allen we talk about the Van Allen radiation belt comes much closer to Earth than just about anywhere else, except for maybe like the poles, where it dips down to 120 miles, which means that when you're in the International Space Station or other places flying overhead, you tend to avoid this region because it's much more intense radiation. It's an actual spot on the Earth that, because of the shape of our magnetic field, it just dips down almost like kind of like a third pole to a degree.
So, okay.
What?
And
it's like some lost stuff. This is like some Dharma foundation stuff.
So how bad is it? I mean, it's bad enough that, like, and forgive me here, I'm gonna speak in unkind terms and I'm gonna sound like I'm being reductionist, and I'm not trying to, but sure, some NASA bureaucrat doesn't want to be on the on the horns for being the guy that flew the International Space Station into the deepest radiation of the planet. But at the same time, like, I mean, we're talking about sending people to Mars and having them be heavily irradiated by cosmic rays and just sort of shrugging, saying, I don't know, 10, 15 years off their life, they're down with it. You know, like how bad is this area?
Well, let me read from the Wikipedia the section marked effects. The South Atlantic anomaly is of great significance to astronomical satellites and other spacecraft that orbit the Earth at several hundred kilometers altitude. These orbits take satellites through the anomaly periodically, expose them to several minutes of strong radiation caused by the trapped protons in the inner Van Allen belt. The International Space Station, orbiting with an inclination of 51.6 degrees, requires extra shielding to deal with this problem. The Hubble Space Telescope does not take observations while passing through the SAA, the South Atlantic anomaly. Astronauts are also affected by the region, which is said to be the cause of peculiar shooting stars, phosphenes, seen in the visual field of astronauts, an effect termed the cosmic ray visual phenomena, which is going to be our band, by the way.
I've heard about this. This is, if I remember correctly, there was some documentary where there was a astronaut who was on the Mir, and he was reporting the phenomenon. If he looked, let's call it due north, everything was fine, but once he turned 90 degrees and is now facing, west, all of a sudden, even if he closed his eyes, he saw bright flashing lights, and it was cosmic rays striking his rods and cones, firing off.
So that happens higher, more there, and so they go on to say that, as far as effects, they say, passing through the South Atlantic anomaly is thought to be the reason for the early failures of the Global Star Network satellites. The PAML experiment, while passing through the SAA, detected anti-proton levels that were orders of magnitude higher than expected. This suggests the Van Allen belt confines antiparticles produced by the interaction of the Earth's atmosphere with cosmic rays. And NASA's reported that modern laptops have crashed when space shuttle flights passed through the anomaly. October 2012, the SpaceX CRS, which is the Dragon spacecraft, attached to the International Space Station, experienced a transient problem as it passed through the anomaly. They believe that a series of events led to the destruction of Hitomi, Japan's most powerful X-ray observatory. The anomaly transiently disabled a direction-finding mechanism, causing the satellite to rely on gyroscopes that were not working properly, after which it spun itself apart.
Holy crap.
Hoo boy. So we have actual... By the way, that bureaucrat, I don't blame him. Don't fly the ISS there.
Well, that's why, I mean, I think that's why you shield for that. And it's just when you look at the map, as we saw there, and you saw there's this zone, and it's just, this brings us, you talk about like, okay, you know, below, you know, you've got the radiation belts will protect us. Then you want to sort of avoid those. Or if you go through those, you want to go through them pretty quickly. But here we have a spot on Earth where this thing dips down to just, you know, 120 miles, which is just really well within low Earth orbit. And, you know, when we start talking about like, well, what are the effects of, you know, this Judea like magnetic spike? We can see that here.
Okay. So how much of this, I mean,
that's a big boy too. That one, it swallows up all of South America.
Yeah.
So
sorry, Brazil.
Well, but keep in mind also, like, this is a big boy as defined by, in any system, you're going to have a best area and a worst area. So our worst area covers what looks like, I don't know, 20% of the Earth's surface, 15% maybe.
It's a lot of the Atlantic Ocean, the South Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah.
But also
nobody
a lot
goes,
of...
Nobody goes there anyway. Well, it's fine. Well. It's fine. No, okay. So here's my question is, right now, that's a problem, and we dodge it because we don't know how to deal with it. But how, like, is it on the table to create shielding that would make this a perfectly safe area? Is this the kind of thing where once we build a magnetic, you know, ion shield or some crap that will protect us, or hardened plates that bounce off all the radiation?
I think so. I think that at some point, as we work on, there's, you know, the right now are the only way we really try to shield ourselves is just, you know, throwing more mass there. But we are working on, you know, electrical generations or systems that, you know, created our own magnetic fields to block the particles. So if that happens, then as far as spacecraft's concerned, then yes, that would help. But as far as, you know, the bigger problem, though, is like we have this big bubbling cauldron of magnetic goo underneath us that at any moment, we don't know, things, poles could flip and we could have intensities. And that's kind of the bigger thing, is showing like, hey, here's this thing, this weird thing going on the surface here that we know that's happening, that wasn't always happening, but it's been happening in, as far as we, you know, our recent history. And there are other things could happen. Things could spike.
Can we talk, and I kind of want Justin's perspective on this. The idea of an EMP strike, technically, should feel more terrifying now than ever, as our reliance on just-in-time management of you know, water, you know, food and supplies, it relies more on technology than ever. You know, I was able to this morning wake up in Crystal River and drive to the airport, not having any idea where I was, but knowing that my magical iPhone was telling me to go the right way and barely paying attention to the road signs, to hop on a plane that was computer controlled to fly to here. Do you worry? It seems like the next great either terrorist threat or environmental disaster, it seems like the next great disaster would be us losing contact with each other and all of the terrifying things that could happen as a result. Do you even worry about that? About running out of, like, you know, oh, there's a blackout, no big deal. And then day seven, it's like, we're all dying of starvation.
Yeah, sure. Why not? I mean, I guess it's not as much of a worry until it happens once, right? Like on a large scale, because we don't even know what the capability of rebuilding is. Like, we know what the capability of rebuilding from a hurricane, from an earthquake, from a fire, from famine, from drought, right? Like, we have a sense of that. There's a blueprint. We really have, number one, the problem is ever shifting as we become more dependent, as you pointed out, but also, like, I don't even know where to begin on how do we get back. How do we rebuild?
But remember, when we talk about EMP, that's a very localized thing. That one is like a little EMP attack, I say. there's a difference, though, that between like a localized sort of thing and a global thing. If it's a localized thing, you know, if you're in the city that's affected or whatever, that's a big thing. But, you know, we have to sort of differentiate between, you know, well, you know, Cleveland lost its Wi-Fi. Boo-hoo. Unless I'm in Cleveland, and then I might, you know, screaming at the top of my lungs.
So let's postulate a situation where it's bad enough that all cell phones are bricked, but slightly older, hardened, more traditional electronics. Like, let's say I have a hard time believing that an old-fashioned landline telephone is going to go out from any reasonable amount of blast from the magnetic center.
Oh, no. I mean, it's going to fry telephone wires.
That seems huge.
That might be even more susceptible because those wires, that's whenever we have
it's solar flares. It's a large collection grid.
Yeah, it's just a big antenna saying, just fry me.
Oof.
Fry me, dog. Yo, you want beef? Fry me.
What about CB radios?
I think we'd be good on that, good buddy.
Okay, all right. So CB radios, and like I'm already thinking in terms of like I have enough gasoline to get me to the warehouse to get the pirate radio. I'm gonna have to buy a generator, aren't I?
Yeah, but does your car fry?
I don't think so. It's a
cars have computers in them now.
As we've discussed on Night Attack, my 2012 Jeep is fairly low tech with manual transmission and that stuff.
And satellite radio.
Okay, well, it's a satellite radio doesn't work anymore.
You're gonna roll up on the spot and like manually roll your window down. Like you can't do this, huh?
Yeah, I'm just rolling my windows up and down, bragging to my neighbors.
Yeah, I mean there are. Anything built in the last several decades could be susceptible. You know, it depends on the severity of the EMP because you have ignition systems and a lot of other stuff that, you know, are vulnerable.
I guess we're going to foreshadow what is now going to be my pick come the end. A lot of this was postulated by or theorized by the author of One Minute After. And in that book, it is a deliberate strike from a rogue nation where they have a single nuke, but there's some paper that suggests that if you fire a nuke at the right level, it creates kind of a cascade effect and creates a massive EMP. And so all of a sudden, all communities are cut off. And one thing, there's a lot about the book that's fairly unbelievable and slightly heavy-handed in my opinion, but the part that I thought was very, very good was the progression of at first, you know, everyone shrugs their shoulders like, blackout, we're having a cookout, all this meat's going to go bad. And so they have a barbecue and it's kind of a party at the beginning. Flash forward to months later, they've gotten word that marauders are coming and the high school students, the high school's been turned into a boot camp for their local militia, and they lose a third of their high school class to marauders, and then finally they're cooking up dogs and stuff. I don't know. It's like that world was a pretty terrifying world, and I'd be scared of that happening.
Wait, how long after it goes out do they result to conscripting the youth into gangs?
They do a reasonable enough job of painting the world where it's months and months, where it's just like, you know, at first it's a party, and then all the cars stopped on the road. They're getting hungry and tired. And there's like this weird moment where people are trying to come on private property. They're like, it's been 12 hours. Let me have some of your water, ma'am. And then, you know, truckers are holding tire irons and getting a little feisty. And then, you know, it does a really good job of painting a progressive deteriorating picture. And so even though I looked up the paper that he built the story on, and it seems like it's less of a threat than it looks like, but not in the scenario Andrew proposed. It could exactly be 1 second after.
Huh. Be warned. Well, if we're looking for another place to go to, breaking news, NASA to host major press conference on discovery beyond our solar system. And NASA to host a major press conference on discovery beyond our solar system is what it's called. The event will see the revelation of major information about exoplanets or planets that orbit stars other than our sun. According to a release, it made no further mention of the details that would be revealed. I guess this is going to be February 22nd. And this is a website that does not provide the date and is not letting me scroll right now because it's trying to load a bunch of video images.
The event will take place on February 22nd, 1 p.m. New York time.
Justin?
Yeah?
Are you waiting with bated breath for this because you totally believe that they're not the little boy who cried wolf and that when NASA says they have an exciting extrasolar announcement that it's going to be genuinely life-changing?
I'm just saying that if you were taking odds on, whether or not within 6 months there will be some kind of correction or retraction to the announcement that we're going to get this week. Say, you know, you would have to lay a little bit of money. To me, that would be the favorite betting destination for me, is that at some point within 6 months we're gonna get some like, well, maybe it's not exactly a planet, you know, maybe it was a smudge on the thing, on the lens.
I would say their exoplanet divisions and all that have been pretty good. You know, they're different departments within NASA, and I would say that some of the life sciences stuff tends to be where, like, between, you know, the 1990s, the Martian meteorite, and then the arsenic thing more recently and all that, they're the ones that seem to be a little more, hey, we did something cool too, where the exoplanet stuff, I don't think it's like, they're like, hey, yeah, turned out our telescope had dust on the lens, we're all alone, no other planets.
So, you know, this is something that you would say likely to be, you know, an exciting piece of information we can build on.
I mean, here's the problem we're in now, is because we'll hear about stuff like, hey, we think there may be some planets out there. And like, okay, then NASA comes out with a press conference and says, hey, guess what, guys? We think there's some planets out there. Like, yeah, no, we've been hearing about that. We're glad you guys are kind of confirming this, but we kind of already heard this thing. So I don't know if it's going to be anything earth-shaking that we haven't already suspected.
Well, I'm going to assume they're going to drop the F word at least once. And they say this is the first planet that has blank, or the first blank planet, or whatever. But we've heard, or maybe their announcement is, for the first time, we've cataloged over 1,000 potential Earth-like rocky planets going around these right kind of stars or whatever. I mean, it'll be cool and we'll be excited about it. It'll also feel iterative and like a minor step forward in a direction we've been feeling for a long time.
I concur. But what within the capability of us knowing that would be cool to know? Because like, we're starting to detect atmospheres around other planets, or think we can. Is it, hey, we've found a bunch of Earth zone planets in this stuff? Or
to be honest, what would be exciting is if they said, we have found Earth's twin. We could confirm for a fact that it has nitrogen, oxygen, CO2, whatever. Although, am I right in remembering this, that the only way oxygen shows up on a planet is if there's some form of life on it? Is that right?
No. Okay. You could have oxygen through other processes, but our oxygen is a product from the.
Oh, doggone it! There's some half remembered quote from
biology.
What I want to say is maybe Pale Blue Dot or something. But there was like a very simple heuristic of like, this thing only happens when there's life. But they certainly wouldn't issue this kind of sleepy press release if they said, "Here's strong evidence of life."
The Armada is flying towards us now.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's more of a 5-alarm fire, right? You know.
I'm going to say it's going to be a roundup. It's going to be some landmark number of Earth-like or Earth zone habitable, like, you know, basically it's going to be a press release that says, your money is not wasted on NASA. We've done this many.
Also, well, I'm Bane, the new NASA administrator.
When he takes questions, it gets really awkward. He's surprised by everyone. He's like, you, Pamela.
Not good at improv.
There's been a big, you know, there's a push coming from the Republicans, which is to push NASA into deep space and to say, let's have other, you know, government organizations do the earth sciences stuff, which, you know,
I think that'd be really interesting. I mean, especially if it's cheaper to do and it can yield results and kind of get people get some new stuff out there, right?
Well,
some new ideas, some new excitement.
That's the key, is once it costs $23.95 to send anything to low Earth orbit, it really doesn't make sense to have a specialized high-end, you know, NASA out there looking at the Earth when they should be looking, you know, outward.
Well, the fear is that it would be a Republican attempt to get rid of all like Earth sciences, though. It's not the idea. The concern is that this, hey, you know, let's push this over to the, you know, NOAA or whatever, and get NASA back into space, but other people are like, yeah, but is this really just to stop Earth monitoring or climate sensing in total?
I mean,
stifle the Earth. Listen, stop listening to Mother Gaia as she speaks to us through her mysterious ways. God,
this really is one of the things that makes me so sad about having a team, because you could take the exact same statement. Obama says it on his way out. Like, the last thing I'm going to do is make NASA go to deep space. And blue teams be all, yay! Red team be all like, bah! And then, you know, 20 minutes later, same statement is like, bah! I don't know.
What was that? Is it? I would love for you to be on, like, CNN. I don't know, Wolf. It just sounds like red team's like, blah, and then blue team's like, meh.
All right. First of all, I'm glad we have enough trust that I don't feel insulted that the host of Politics, 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 who has been one of the lead correspondents on BitTorrent News, just mocked me as a potential CNN guest.
No, I think it would be better. I mean, I don't know if you've watched much CNN lately. I'd rather somebody just like literally call them braying goats. I'll tell you what, you can do much more than goat braying when you go to patreon.com/nightattack. That is where you can support this show. Weird thing. Too many Patreons. Patreon.com/weirdthings, rather, is where you can support the show.
Patreons. Those are people who sit on an altar and put their hands together and hold a bill in between them and hand them to us. Join one of the Patreons at patreon.com/weirdthings. We are 7 Patreons away from hitting YOLEO 420.
But thank you guys. You guys have been very, very, very supportive of this show, and we very much appreciate it. Go ahead and check us out, patreon.com/weirdthings.
Just to clarify, oxygen in significant quantities is indicative of life. We don't know of any process that produces the ratio that we have. There are other places like moons, like Saturn moons and stuff that have oxygen, but it's like just small amounts.
The important thing, I would hate if I was holding on to the wrong element this whole time, but I'm glad I remember the right element.
Yeah, no, it's good. If we detected, like, you know, like an exoplanet with an oxygen atmosphere, that would be indicative of, we'd be like, well, the only process we know that would produce the amount that we could detect from here would be life.
Good. So, okay. That is exciting. Well, I mean, and again, if that were the announcement, my guess is we'd have a louder press announcement than this.
Or unless they're like, yeah, but then remember how Justin came down on us the last time. You know, we don't want to just go yell about it because Mr. Robert Young.
What happened? When did I yell at anybody? I'm a docile.
Yell at NASA. You were just yelling at NASA earlier.
Well, no, I was being snarky, certainly.
We have live on the air. NASA. NASA, are you there?
Hi. Justin, you hurt my feelings. I'm NASA.
Now how do you feel, wow, Justin?
That would mean you shouldn't have said that.
I'm so sorry, NASA.
Yeah.
What are you doing right now? You sound like you're in pain.
I'm just writing the announcement for tomorrow.
you're writing the announcement?
I'm writing the announcement.
Announced it before you even wrote it?
You gotta write it. By the way, what's the announcement?
It's
not telling you now.
Oh, I gotta go. Obama's calling me. Click.
How would you describe what blue team be like, and conversely, what red team be like?
Well, blue team be like Houston, and then red team be like Houston.
Hang up on NASA. I'm sorry.
All right, so long, NASA. Get out of here.
Just get out, NASA. He may be the most important human achievement we've ever done, in most, you know, thing that if we were point to what are we proudest of, maybe NASA would be that. But get out. Get out. Yeah. We're done with you now.
Hey, I know that we're trying.
I got one more.
One more.
One more thing. This is just I gotta get your. There was a consulting firm. I don't know if they were hired, but they're making recommendations on what should be the new Air Force One plane.
What kind of plane?
Yeah, they had a suggestion on there saying, like, if we want to, like, for future presidents, if we wanted to, like, maybe allow them to have the safest, best way to get them from place to place, which could be you not have to worry about enemies attacking them, whatever, missiles, etc. The suggestion was by Wright, Williams, and Kelly Consulting, as they suggested what we should probably be using for Air Force One is the B-21 bomber.
Oh, goodness.
What?
That seems like that would not send out the best, because the stealth bomber, because you wouldn't be able to see it anywhere.
I mean, it's like the, you know, this is the thing that looks like Batman's airplane.
Yeah, well, and also is an instrument of war, might send a bit of a controversial message out at this fragile time.
Well, all right, so what would be, aside from it just being aesthetically something that is jarring, like, what would be, I mean, because, like, the point of Air Force One is to get people, is to get important cargo from point A to point B, right?
The concern is vulnerability to surface-to-air missiles. The concern is that as we fly our head of, you know, state around, you know, again, Air Force One as it is has a lot of deterrence and stuff like that. It's like if you look at the president's limo, you notice, you look at the glass on that stuff and you realize that windshield's like, it's like, that's thick. There's like other procedure. Like it's not a normal, it looks on the surface like a normal car. Then you look closer, you're like, oh man, this is not a normal car. Same thing with the Air Force One currently. But the idea of the B-21 is that is, you know, surface-to-air missiles and these other things become more prevalent and more sophisticated that, you know, flying the president around in this big thing with the logo on it may not be the smartest way to avoid a conflict. So if you moved the president into a B-21 stealth bomber, which is designed to avoid these deterrents, it might be a safer means of transportation. And also protection against electronic attacks, etc.
Have you read Radley Balko's amazing book, Rise of the Warrior Cop?
No, I'm familiar with it, though.
It makes a very compelling case where, you know, it paints a time that the local police served as adjudicators to local disputes. It took care of people who, you know, were in trouble, and you know, you dealt with drunks, and then when there was a dispute, you resolved it, and you took, you know, somebody beats up his wife, you took him to jail, and that kind of stuff. The drug war really perverted. It injected money, and the war on terrorism injected insane amount of monies, and all of these police forces got big budgets, and they have to spend the money or else they don't get it again. And so you get a bunch of folks who are like, well, what would be cool and that we could justify because it would make us safer? And it turns out dressing everyone as cyborgs, as soulless robots that are there to intimidate, like literally that's one of the reasons they say it's like, plus this will have intimidation for those darn, you know, drug folks. And of course, you know, they're kicking down doors and shooting flashbangs that are severely melting the faces of toddlers and stuff. It seems to be, I would say, after my reading of it, this is just my opinion, that it's more trouble than it's worth. I think that to put any president,
but especially this one,
in an instrument of war to parade around, might have perverse, intense, horrifying, unintended consequences.
You know, sure. I guess the concern is it's the you don't, we can talk about what our present threats are, but what are the future threats? You know, we don't realize that what a threat is until sometimes after it happens. And the concern here is like, You have ISIS using drones now to drop bombs on people, right? They're using this very cheap, readily accessible technology now. They're doing that. Surface-to-air missiles are finding their way from China and Russia and all that to these different regimes, which are not state players that don't care. you know, and so the concern there is that, like, okay, if we have this technology that we think could prevent this major problem from happening, their suggestion is we should consider using this. They're not, and I the warrior cop thing, I agree. There's a community policing problem in many places. There is a lack of training. There's a lot of issues at play there. Here's sort of, and I'm not saying I'm for this, but the ideas are saying, listen, if you want, what is the best means to protect them? Well, it's this, you know, and
well, let me ask you this, Brian. If this was not, I think, because part of the problem now is that this is very obviously the high water famous celebrity version of new war technology from a certain era, right? Sure. If it did not look like that, and maybe you had a smiley face on it and it looked a little bit more stately, would it just be the new version of Air Force One? Like, would it just be like, yeah, times change, planes change? You know, where there's more stuff in the air. Now Air Force One looks like a hang glider and not a tube anymore.
No, and my evidence of that is I would say the biggest criticism of, and again, I've not been there, and I certainly can't speak, whatever. The only criticism I've seen of the rebuilding of One World Trade and the 9/11 museum stuff is the fact that it's a hardened bunker, and they do their best to dress it up architecturally speaking, but it is built to withstand a massive strike, and in many ways that is a scar that gives a message that is not consistent with what many people would feel like an American attitude of live and let live, give us your tired, your poor, your yearning masses huddled, and all that stuff. And I feel like this would be a similar thing. Like, you could dress it up however you want. That's an effing bomber. That's an instrument of war, the best instrument of war. It reeks of fear and the idea that, well, this is what we need because our president is definitely a hated target worldwide, and it's not something I'm comfortable with.
I mean, but wouldn't that be the same argument for, like, and I'm not saying you're wrong, but isn't that kind of the same argument for, like, bulletproof glass on the limo?
Agreed. And I don't think we should have bulletproof glass. I mean, if you are doing – here's the thing. If you're doing your job as a cop, you don't need more than a nightstick. If you're doing it properly.
What?
Can I finish? I mean, you could have guns in the if you are overstepping your bounds, then you probably need something more. If you're doing your job as the president, you probably don't need bulletproof glass. If you're overstepping your bounds, then you probably do. And all of that to say is, because here's the problem, is one dedicated person is all it takes to sacrifice their life to take out a president. And we've seen that time and time again. Is if somebody values killing the president more than themselves, there's virtually nothing you can do to stop it. So why don't you acknowledge that and instead give the impression that you will behave in a way that you want to minimize the number of people willing to sacrifice their life to take yours.
All right, let's back up for a second. Okay, so a cop only needs a nightstick. How many bar fights have you had to break up?
Hold on. No, that's an unfair comparison. I'm not using my experience. I'm using the historical precedent. Used to be the cops walked around with two sticks, a day stick and a night stick. That's where the long stick comes from because people were rowdier at night.
What was considered police brutality at that point? Okay, what was overstepping their bounds at that point?
This is unfair shotgunning. You're asking me for facts that you know that I can't provide, and they're insignificant to my argument.
Well, I don't. You think they're insignificant? Okay, I'll use family example. Okay, my father was a police officer in one of the worst parts of Atlanta. Okay, when he had some very unfashionable opinions about maybe white people and black people getting along. He was assigned the night districts. He was assigned the drunks. He was assigned the worst part of town at all. Okay. Now, it was a very different time, very, very different time. My father managed and all that, but things got progressively worse. When you start dealing with people who are incapacitated, who are inebriated, people who are drunk, or people who hate cops, okay, I think that putting a cop out there with just a nightstick is sort of a naive sort of idea. And the idea that, oh, yeah, that's all you need is because everybody's going to be a well-behaved citizen. Some people aren't. Some people are violent. Some people are more powerful than you. Sometimes you have to deal with gangs. Sometimes you have to do a lot of stuff. And I think that
then by that same logic, why shouldn't they be armed with Tommy guns? Why did we take away automatic weapons from them?
Oh, because Tommy guns will hit and have a habit of, you know, hitting lots of, you know, innocent people. They're not as discriminating.
Unlike the weapons they have now, which how often do they hit? Now, this is me doing the unfair thing to you and saying you cite statistics on there fewer innocent people
hit. We could have a long, and you keep interrupting, we could have a long discussion about, you know, what, you know, how are things escalated and how do we deal with conflicts? When we moved from cities where you knew who everybody was, you knew who the local drunk was, you knew who the problem was, but then when you move to larger cities and you have more complicated situations and you have citizens who are armed, if you pull a car over and you don't know if they're armed or not, okay, do you want your cop not to be armed? What becomes the threat from policing then? If you are a violent actor, you know, what is your, do you care? Do you, you know, if you can, you know, the cops aren't armed and you are, what's the difference?
Well, and that's the tragedy, is that there's no end to that argument. That argument, no matter how armed they are, you can always use that argument to make them a little more armed, a little more protected, a little more wrapped up in this body armor, looking like a robot.
I didn't bring up any of that. My argument is that I think that in many instances in policing, that I think that it's essential that we allow our cops to carry guns, because there are situations where they have to go and you know, do things. Coming from father's a cop, my brother's a cop. I'm hard to imagine how my brother would do a hostage rescue situation without a gun. That would be tactically interesting to see how that would happen. And then when you talk about nobody can stop a dedicated person from killing the president, it happens every day. Secret Service every day stop people who have, we don't know how dedicated they are, how capable they are, but that happens all the time. As far as figuring out people who have plots, there are good plots, there are dumb plots, there are people who are highly capable, there are people who are incapable. Okay, do you want to make it easy enough that anybody who wants to kill the president can kill the president? Is that your goal?
I mean, that's ascribing a heck of a motivation to my statement, but
what's your answer? Should it be easy? Should it be easier to kill the president?
Okay, that's a dumb question, and I'm not going to answer it.
No, it's not dumb to me, Brian. It's sincerely not dumb to me. You're saying no bulletproof glass. That I do not see the difference there.
I am saying I would respect a president more if he wasn't traveling in an iron box at all time. It seems like and that's the extent of what I'm saying. I am saying me, Brian Brushwood, would respect a president more if he said, I am so confident that I'm doing what's right for everyone and that I'm listening to everybody and that I am acting as a fair executor of laws in this land, that I do not feel the need. I need to hide in an iron box.
Okay.
So to that point, and on the flip side, I am saying that I feel, me, Brian Brushwood, I feel like a perverse consequence of increasing protectionist equipment is that you get situations where, during the guy who is shooting folks in Dallas, where the during one of the cop rallies or whatever, where he was shooting folks, saying cops need to die. And rather than give him a fair trial, rather than come in, rather than try to defuse the situation, they strapped a grenade to a bomb defusal robot, rolled it in, and straight up assassinated him. And I don't think that was a great carriage of justice. And the only reason that moment existed is because they had overprepared and had overly defended themselves to where the tools they had were nothing but hammers, you know?
Justin, give me a second here. Okay. You just compounded two events there. That's a separate event from talking about how we protect the president.
Well, that's
okay?
Correct. I gave two opinions of me, Brian Brushwood.
Okay. Let's talk about John Hinckley Jr., okay? What motivated him to want to shoot the president? Was it because he was looking at Reagan's politics? Was it because he's sitting there reading, the New York Times and saying, you know what? I think this man is a tyrant. I need to take him out. He was crazy. Hinckley Jr. was a crazy man.
Yes,
he was a crazy person.
Ill.
Okay.
Yes.
So no matter what policies were in place there, he wanted to kill somebody famous, and the president tends to be the most famous person there is. I don't understand. You're like, well, if you're a just president, you're like, yeah, if there are no schizophrenics, if there are no crazy people, there are no idealists.
Here's your problem. The problem with your logic, Andrew, is what you've done. Let's say you put the president in an iron box. You've saved the president, and you've killed Howard Stern or someone else. Like if what he wants is if he's
I lock
mental,
my door, they're gonna rob my neighbor. Is that your attitude?
Again, I would prefer that we not have any part of this conversation where you put words in my mouth. But
Brian, you just did that to me. You just did that to me. You said, this is what you're saying. This is what you just did to me. You don't get to use that tactic and then say, I can't apply it. I'm trying to find an equivalency here. Okay?
No. I'm saying that a side effect of your proposed scenario does not yield a decrease in the number of deaths.
If there's one death we want to prevent, you know, what causes them? There's a reason why Secret Servicemen and women, why they have to throw their, they commit themselves to throwing themselves in a line of fire, is to do that. They say, let's prevent this one. Okay. You're saying if you're powerful, if we're the president of the United States, you should not use these means to protect yourself from this crazy person.
Again, I feel like you're not hearing me. I'm saying I respect you
less. I'm hearing
you
exactly. I'm just trying to understand you.
Okay. I'm saying I respect you less. I'm saying that I respect somebody who doesn't wrap himself in an iron box because he feels like he has the conviction of his actions and is willing to stand up.
Let me ask a hypothetical, and if this is unfair to your point, then stop me.
Sure.
But let's say that you continue, Brian Brushwood, Modern Rogue, continues to become a success, right? And that it becomes such a success that you are now out on the road, not only performing, but doing lectures about all the cool things you can learn, right? And then for whatever reason, let's make it as cartoonishly unreasonable as possible just for the sake of this, the sake of this example. Somebody starts noticing and you notice amongst the popularity of your channel that Brian is sneaking in messages from the Illuminati into his Modern Rogue videos, and it's brainwashing the children. And now all of a sudden you start to notice at your live performances that there are, you know, maybe some weird elements. So people are protesting and maybe it gets a little violent. Maybe you have during the Q&A there, it becomes more frequent that somebody starts standing up and screaming, and it gets just like that weird sort of vibe. The natural thing from what other people who have been in similar situations would be, all right, either put in new increased security to make sure that guns can't come in to the thing, put in metal detectors and make sure people are frisked before they come in to the performance venue, and to assign you, Brian Brushwood, the talent, more bodyguards that would make sure that should somebody try to run up on you, that would be taken care of. What my question is, how is that, in that scenario, is it your responsibility to moderate and deal with the fringe group from an information level?
Well, I think that we're conflating two different issues, because the entire scenario boils down to everything you described. Let's take it. It's like, but what if you're scared? Well, if I'm scared, then I, of course, would have to decide if I wanted to have increased things. But let's take a very realistic example, very similar to that. I respected Glenn Beck less when he attended a rally wearing a bulletproof vest, very visibly right up in front. I feel like if you're somebody who is being a good steward of your position, that you should hope. Like you should minimize outward displays of fear, and because they tend to polarize. And I feel like right now we don't need a lightning rod of polarization in this country. I would say now is a real good time for us to not have everything to the absurd. You know, why not have the president show up to every speech in full body armor and with a mask on? Maybe one with a respirator that makes him breathe and gives his bassy voice a deep, you know, resonant thing that will inspire authority in others. You know, it's like I don't want my president giving speeches in bulletproof armor. I don't want him flying around in a B-2 bomber. I don't dig any of that. And that's my opinion. You know, that's me. That's not the kind of leader that I really, really respect. How about that?
Catch me outside. How about that?
Fair enough. Let's go to the world of manatees.
Actually, there's a crossover, because after we did the manatee things, I saw the exciting news that SpaceX was this their first successful launch since the explosion? The second.
This is the first. They used it from the historic launch pad for the space shuttle 39, I think 39A, which was where, in the movie, by the way, Tomorrowland. At the very beginning, the girl, there's this construction project at NASA that she's sabotaging. And I actually on Twitter, I'm like, wait, that's the retrofit of that launch pad for SpaceX. So she's trying to stop SpaceX. And like the writers of the movie are like, no, she's pro SpaceX. I'm like, well, not in your movie. So this is a historic launch pad that has been. So that was the kind of what's significant there is that that's the kind of the return to flight from there, which is where the, you know, most of the shuttle missions went from, et cetera. So.
Well, shuttle missions. And this is where, am I right in thinking it was this where the Apollo astronauts took off from?
Yeah, most of the moon missions too. And if SpaceX has their way, this is going to be where they're going to launch their ITS, Interplanetary Transport System. So Launch Complex 39, there are three launch pads, 39A, 39B, and 39C. And also what's significant too is this was a NASA facility. Previously, they've been using the Air Force launch pads at Canaveral. So this is a Kennedy Space Center launch, I think, was the first for SpaceX.
Is there any reading of the tea leaves? Because, you know, somebody somewhere approved this. Is this some kind of tacit acknowledgement that SpaceX seems to be having their act together and that they appear to be the, I don't know, the future of commercial space travel?
I know that there was some fighting over trying to get, I think, this particular launch pad, because I know that they had to compete with, you know, Blue Origin was saying that they wanted to have it, and that was the Elon Musk famous quote, unicorns dancing in the exhaust flames.
Oh, geez.
Before Blue Origin's able to launch or something like that. So, SpaceX is in a very interesting position because there are many people within NASA and the Air Force and the government that would love to have a very reliable, cost-effective commercial partner to do this. But, you know, the previous two, you know, accidents have, you know, affected confidence, you know, and that's something that SpaceX has to just keep up a good cadence of launching things and not having things blow up. So
how confident are we? Like, did they, man, I don't think we've checked in on this. Did they definitively figure out what caused the fast fire / explosion?
They released their statement saying that effect.
Right? Yeah.
okay. What was the short version of it? Like, was it just a part up, not up to spec, or?
No, well, it was because when they were using you put liquid helium inside of a tank so that will provide pressure to help the fuel continue to flow. And they had the super cooled liquid helium went through there, or not super, the cryogenically cooled liquid helium went in there, and they put the oxygen in there, and they think there may have been some sort of defect in the line or something like that, which caused an ignition point. And they said that by changing the loading procedure, they could probably minimize.
So they acknowledged a reason and said, and we have a patch or a fix.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Dude, that's exciting. Okay. So I did not see the actual news reports. Did you watch it live by any chance?
No, I did not.
I saw a CNN news report, and this was at a Chili's last night, so I'm only reading the closed captioning. But one of the eyewitnesses said it was amazing because the thing took off, and right at the moment that it breaks the sound barrier, and of course it takes time for the sound to travel down, but it's like you get blasted by the sound barrier after takeoff, the sonic boom, and then right just seconds afterwards, you see that first stage descending out of the low-hanging clouds, you know, lighting up the sky, coming back down and landing. It was, I mean, they looked like they had just seen the best Grateful Dead concert ever. Might have been high as a kite, I don't know. But they, like, they had those wide eyes of amazement on them, for sure.
It's, I can only imagine what it's like to be there to see that in person.
Okay.
That's got to be crazy. I mean, the fact that also this is something that's happening on, at such a hallowed ground where such history has already been made, to watch something as technically advanced, where we did not think that this was possible or like feasible, as short a time as it was ago, is just awesome and amazing and really just a crowning achievement for SpaceX.
Well, there was a, turns out Elon Musk is actually a SpaceX truther.
What?
Somebody had asked him, said, hey, why do most of the landings take place at night? And his response on Twitter was, it's easier to fake the CGI.
Man, I'll tell you what. It's like on one hand, That's a very funny joke to make on Twitter. On another hand, you just know it's going to be in somebody's, you know, like manifesto.
Well, and we talked about this. Our friend Richard Garriott, when he was, you know, taking his trip to the International Space Station, he had joked about like, you know, maybe, you know, just like one-on-one to somebody at NASA saying like, oh man, maybe I'll get on the ham radio. Because of course, that's not the ISS's equipment. He brought his own ham radio up to radio back to Earth. And he'd be like, I don't know. I see like lights. It looks like... fast flying objects all around. And it was like that sense of dread that can only come from 20 years of somebody fielding conspiracy theories about orbital objects that are, you know, extraterrestrial.
Yeah. Like, no. did you want to talk about your manatee experience?
Oh, it was great. Justin and I, we talked about this on Night Attack, but we went to Crystal River on a pro gig, which, by the way, I'm hoping we'll be able to talk about pretty soon.
Soon, yeah. I mean, theoretically, if there was anything to talk about, hopefully those things would be available sometime within the next month or so.
Well,
I would hope.
Hypothetically, I don't think we would get in trouble if we mentioned that you and I had gone to Florida on a series of adventures on Discovery's dime.
I mean, yeah, we there were certainly social media posts of us in Florida doing fun. on top of that, I know that, you know, I certainly have very strong opinions about vehicles that people should purchase.
Well, and we so we went, and one of the things we did was we went to Crystal River, which, you know, has hundreds and hundreds of manatees. Here's the part I didn't know, Justin, is I heard that back in the 70s, like, there's apparently video you could see of Jacques Cousteau, who saved a manatee who was injured, and then he brought the manatee to Crystal River. And this is at a time when the migration only had, like, 15 manatees. Wow. I don't know if it's, like, deer, where I'll say manatees. But he built a place to rehabilitate, and then they released the manatee back into the wild. And you can actually see Crystal River, the Three Sister Springs, as it looked. Oh my God! Wow, it looks the same.
This is from The Forgotten Mermaids, Then and Now.
Yeah. And so you see them setting up stuff. Basically, there's this spot where, you know, there's a spring that's 73 degrees year round, and so when it gets cold in the Gulf, generations now of mothers have taught their pups to, I don't know, calves, I don't know, to migrate up to 1500 miles to this spot. And there's a few wacky months where you can dive in and swim around with the manatees. And let me tell you, if you have the means to swim there with 2 to 3 little girls who think it's the coolest thing ever, then I highly recommend it. In fact, yeah, that's right. We got a little bit of footage. Here.
Explain it for the people who are listening to the audio, what we're looking at.
Yeah. There, you're seeing my daughter Penny, like 4 feet away from a sea cow, swimming past, and they're all super chill, just kind of like, oh, excuse me, sir. And if you jump forward, you can see this is outside of the spring where the water's a little bit cloudy, but inside of the spring.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and this is just at the edge of the spring. Jump forward like 6 or 7 more, and I think you can actually see the water bubbling out from the sand underneath, and it's this amazing grotto that looks like it's straight out of Jurassic Park or Jurassic World. Hopefully, neither. It was delightful. It was delightful, and the kids had a really good time. If you have the means, I highly recommend it. It was so good that after doing it professionally with Justin, I went home and I was like, hey, I can either bring these kids some plush toys and a vague promise that I'll take them, or we can, you know, bend schedules upside down and backwards to make it happen. I'm so glad that we did the latter. It was really extraordinary.
Yeah, the one thing that I would say for anybody in the Southeast, even if you've been around manatees, number one, the sheer volume of them is something that's really, really fun. And also, I had never really done a ton of freshwater snorkeling that was as clear as that is, because it's, you know, feeding into the Atlantic Ocean. But it was really something extraordinary. And you realize, you know, that freshwater, especially near springs, like snorkeling is definitely a different game when you can actually, like, you know, accidentally. When you swallow water, you're not like gagging immediately.
Well, and plus also like just it being so clear, like you almost get a sense of vertigo when you look down and you feel like you're just really high up. Here you can see me trying to swim down and blow an air ring and failing terribly. But it was a man, it's hard for me to believe that was just 24 hours ago. That was insane.
That is some very, very pretty water there. And some of those springs go pretty deep and are like pretty old too, as far as finding like prehistoric creatures at the bottom.
I feel like I let you down. I should have come back with a tale of a merbeast that I found.
Yeah, Brian. I don't know if you know the show. It's Weird Things.
Dang it.
It's called Vacation Things.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, you know, not too far from a bit to the east of there is Silver Springs, where they shot a lot of like some of the James Bond movies and stuff. And then even further south into the on the East Coast, actually, it was funny. I was watching a Bond movie. I'm looking it up like, oh, they shot this in Silver Springs. Some stuff's like done in Crystal Springs, Crystal River. And then I realized like, man, they shot this really cool sequence right up the canal from where my parents live.
Oh, that's awesome.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Anybody know what time it is?
Oh, I think it's time for Journey Quest!
Where were we last time?
We were last in the King's Chamber. We tried to escape and then realized through repeated reminders from the ether that we could best take advantage of this situation by pretending to be the infirmed, now deceased king. And have me be the new chief advisor.
That's right.
To the
That's
king.
Right. Well, and then you were drafted into the king's army, I believe.
Yes, and now we were drafted into a fight, which is the first decision that the king had to make was whether or not to send a battalion to fend off incoming marauders.
Now, at this point, like, help me remember, because I know that I was wearing the armor. And I think we're was I able to speak, or did I have to just communicate in gestures and grunts so as not to be detected as a false king?
You can whisper, and Justin can interpret it for you.
Okay, good.
Yeah,
good. All right.
So next thing you know, the Duke's right hand man has opened up the doors. They put a table in front of you. They've got a map. On the map, they show your kingdom, they show the perimeter, and they've laid out little soldiers, wooden soldiers all around. They're like, all right, these are the marauders coming. It's not marauders. You know, it's an invading force. It's the next kingdom over, and they're ready to take over us. We need to do something about this. And here are our troops. And you guys seem like kind of original thinkers, like out-of-the-box thinkers. We need some strategies. We need some thinking. And this is a hint, hint. You guys are from the 21st century, you know. Maybe you have some cool ideas for how to wage war.
Number one, Justin.
Everybody only gets nightsticks. Okay.
He's like, because if we were truly good stewards of this kingdom, we wouldn't have anything to fear from competing kingdoms.
I mean, would be the problem. All right. But aside from that, hey, folks, you're just trying to make jokes here. Try the veal. Is this thing on? Okay. So here's what we're going to do. Brian, I mean, I'm the Duke. What do you have any ideas on modern? What year is it? We need to figure this out.
All right, I examined the board. Can I get an idea of tactically what's laid out before me? Because as somebody who's played a fair amount of, you know, Warcraft and Starcraft, I feel like I know what a top-down perspective. I'm assuming there's little soldiers and sticks that we can move stuff around.
Yep, totally. It's there.
Okay,
and they got a guy in the corner who'll carve whatever you need to.
Okay. All right. And so how big is the force? Are they coming? What direction are they coming in from?
You're basically surrounded.
Hoo boy. I lean over to Justin.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, remember that time we did that Discovery VR video about the Alamo?
Sure. Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Do you remember any military lessons that we learned during that?
Yeah, more PR. I mean, like, those guys had great PR, right? They all died, and people are still, like, yelling about, hey, did you forget him? Because you shouldn't.
Okay.
So let's just start talking about how heroic. In fact, everybody, new decree. I say, hey, listen, just whisper in my ear. Just doesn't have to be anything.
Okay. I say, hey, I'm whispering at you right now.
Yeah. The Duke has a new decree. Everybody constantly tell each other how brave they are. And just make sure that you repeat your first and last name. All start. Justin Young. Justin Young was here and he was very brave.
Okay. All right. I shake my head inside the armor and I lean over and I say, we need something out of the box to stop this. See if you can figure out from context clues when in history we are and where this is. Maybe it's a famous battle that we know how it usually goes.
I lean over to the king's army officials and I just go like...
It's the Duke, but that's fine. You keep calling him the king. It's fine.
The Duke's military officials and I'm just like, man, who's got the time? Anybody got the time? Time? Place? Where are we at? I mean, I'm just trying to figure it out, you know, just to see if you know.
I point to the name written on the map as if to imply like, hey, this is probably the name of where we are. Just act like it's mistranslated and verify that it's correct.
What is it on the map? What do we see?
The Dukedom of El Rockdom.
Gosh, I got it. I mean, I'm guessing everyone's speaking English, right? Like, you know, unless we have like some TARDIS thing.
I mean, it's weird. You have trouble understanding a bit, but you know, you kind of mostly grasp it.
Man, I feel like we don't have any historical reference to hold on to, Justin. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if it wasn't even a time machine, and in fact, just moved us to a different part of a more advanced place in the apocalypse. I don't know, but that's neither here nor there. We're surrounded, and they're coming for us.
What's that famous move that happens when you are surrounded?
Play dead.
Wait for the elven army. Hey, y'all got any elvens, elvens around?
haven't heard of the elvens.
Okay.
The friends of yours?
Hey,
I'd like it.
Okay, hold on. Real quick. These marauders, these people invading the other kingdom... Do they have a particular style of dress? Would it be possible for us to fashion like enough impromptu costumes that the moment they invade, we could all pretend to be them, and then in the flurry of, you know, whoa, just, you know, vacate and then take over their places?
You know, they've got kind of a motley sort of look. I mean, different. You know, they've sort of teamed together a bunch of different kingdoms and stuff, or their own sort of, you know, people together and rulers and stuff. So,
but they don't have like a, you know, they're not all wearing, you know, pale blue armbands or something.
All right, I swagger to the table and I slam my hand on it and I say, "Everybody, shut up! The answer to this question is right in front of us. What we have to do is build a fake castle that they think is the real castle. And when they siege that castle, we'll sneak up right behind them and totally mop the floor with them. It's what I like to call the lesson of the parable of Blazing Saddles."
All right. I become increasingly convinced that they're not going to recognize my voice from behind the mask. And I just ask, hey, what kind of weapons do we have?
We got, you know, some swords, some axes, some daggers.
I know, because I'm the Duke, that I pretty much almost certainly have a black ops division that I don't tell a lot of people about. Did I let you in on that? I have a hard time remembering.
No, but we got chemists and stuff. I mean, if you guys were like from some land and had knowledge about like really cool things you could make, that would be great.
I start clapping my gauntlets together and I say, "Let's go, bring the chemists. Let's go, bring the chemists."
All right, in shuffles a guy. He's missing an eyebrow because it's burned off, and there's like holes in his cloak and stuff. And he's like, "I'm the chemist. What can I do for you,
Brian?"
Does the king want more of the mushrooms? I've got more of the mushrooms.
I say, "No, I'm not addicted to these." And I grab a fistful of mushrooms and stuff them in my mailed pocket.
Hey, chemist, you ever have one of them chemistry experiments that leads to sudden and violent fireballs and explosions?
Oh, yeah.
All right. So, what do you say we do our best to put those behind some kind of short tube And we invent the exploding nightstick.
That way, we'll still be keeping to my decree that only nightsticks are allowed. They'll just be really fast, far-flung nightsticks propelled by a combination of explosive gases.
Well, okay, I don't remember the precise exact formula. Could you help me out here?
It's bird poop? Charcoal? I think this is real. Phosphorus? I take a moment, I put my mailed gauntlets together, and I pray to the weirdest god of all. I say, if you're out there, somewhere in Diamond Town, greatest DJ in
no
the land.
No fair. Not allowed to do that. You got to do this on your own.
Damn it.
You got to do this on your own.
My prayer goes unanswered. Okay. Okay. I seem to remember gunpowder is charcoal, phosphorus, and something else. Okay. Oh, no, no, no. I turn to the chemist and I say, have ye any volatile oils, the likes of which lights quite quickly?
Sure, do. Got
great.
It.
Great. Okay. Justin, we can make potato guns. We can make potato guns. A potato gun is you need a chamber that you put hairspray in that's sealed off and some way to light it on the inside and then a PVC tube with a potato in it. Only instead of a potato, we could do like, you know, just, I don't know, pods of we'll call it wildfire because we're not original. And it'll launch over there and the flaming jelly will hit them and then they'll burn alive.
Not original. When he writes it, he'll be ripping us off.
Good point. Good point. Okay, so I say, how many? Is there bamboo in this land? Ask him if there's bamboo in this land.
Yo, where the bamboo at?
There's no bamboo. No bamboo. Damn.
Okay. Well, okay. I real quick. I draw a picture of potato cannons, and I say, "Can you make this?" And with diagrams, I point to, you know, the chamber being coated and stuff, and the way to light it with a spark, maybe a flint and steel.
Yep. Build it.
Great. How many can you build, and how fast? And will it happen? Can we be prepared for this invasion?
Well, you know. Since our Duke had ordered something called a bong, we never explained what they were for. We actually have a bunch of the tubes already made.
Sweet, sweet. Perfect. Also,
hey, what do you say? Could you just pour a lot of that very, very, very unstable liquid in just a bunch of bottles? Also, just go ahead and find some of the finest linens in the land. Just go ahead and stuff them right at the stem of the bottle. And I want all of the army's surest-handed men to be ready to throw those upon lighting the linen.
Done. Done. They will follow your orders explicitly.
Okay. So, hey, what time, and I hold my mailed fist up as if there's a wristwatch there and point to my wrist, and I say, what time is this invasion planned for?
You know, they're getting ready any time now. You know, we have some good perimeters up there, but, you know, maybe being able to strike them first might not be a bad idea. And what was this thing you mentioned with, you said charcoal and stuff? Did you ever figure out what you want with that?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I had this dream in which I was watching an episode of something called Transformers, where they went back to the Middle Ages, and Starscream was definitely covered in bird poop as he came and he says, I've got the phosphorus and I should also lead the Decepticons. And they invented gunpowder, and that's definitely where I'm stealing this idea from. But that was all in a dream, and I knew it was phosphorus from bird poop and charcoal. I don't know what else.
Yeah, it's that other thing, Brian. It's that other thing.
Gunpowder. I really want to cheat, but I shouldn't cheat. Damn.
I will say, by the way, when you looked at your wrist from the back of the room, Albert J. Wristwatch just said, hey, that gives me an idea.
Not knowing the answer, I just shrug and say, I don't know, try saltpeter.
Well, yeah, you see, you might be
your saltpeter and your phosphorus thing are a little bit fuzzy there. There's a third thing. There's a third thing you need. A third thing.
Oh, wait, wait. Hold on. Hold on. Hold on. Hold on. I looked at Justin pleadingly, and I mouthed the words. I lift up the mailed face so that he can see me. I'm looking away from everyone. I'm high. Okay, I lift it halfway up so he can see my lips as I mouth the words. Help me.
I don't know. Wood. Wood chips. Sawdust.
Let's try wood. I don't know.
All right. You want sawdust chips?
Yeah, yeah. That all right, sure.
I got a big barrel of sulfur. I'll just go dump that out and go
sulfur.
Collect all of your salt, your chips and stuff.
I slap my mailed knee and it rings out in front of everyone as I remember sulfur.
All right. Sulfur, charcoal, and
saltpeter. Saltpeter.
Saltpeter.
Yeah.
Saltpeter. Word we all know, but we don't know what it is. But we'll just
no, yeah. I know, yeah. Edgar J. Saltpeter says coming right up.
Yeah. So, all right, I'm gonna send my little assistant off to go mix that up. All right, he's fast. He's fast. Boom. let me go check in on that. Not good. I need another assistant. Is there more specific instructions?
I say make.
At this point, I go into a musical line by line Disney-esque song where I describe how to make gunpowder in the key of Mary Poppins.
Done. So now I've got bags and bags of gunpowder.
I didn't know that was an option. How did I know that? Ah, damn it!
Apparently, you could just roll for knowledge here.
God,
all right.
Oh, yeah. All right. All right.
Well, the first thing you need to do is grab that charcoal.
I was waiting for the whole thing.
So now you've got scads and tons of gunpowder.
Okay. So now I say I want 10,000 bags of this gunpowder.
Whoa, 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 whoa. We're not China here. Okay.
All right. I want as many bags as you can muster, and I want them all piled up in front of the front of this castle, okay? And my word is infallible because I'm the Duke. As many as you can muster, put them all right in front of the castle, and then wait until the army comes near.
The Duke. All right. Hey, Duke.
Whispering.
Great job, man. Great job. Hey, it's me, Justin. I'm the one who sang about how to make gunpowder. So here's the thing. He's very tired. So we're just going to go ahead and take the spirit of his instructions and not actually the letter of it. And what we're going to do is take all that gunpowder and those I'm going to call them Justin cocktails.
Okay. First of all right, Justin. I have a plan.
We have to go take them on because if we go and with the element of surprise, hit them with technology they've never seen before, it'll be better than waiting until we're literally under siege.
Okay, hold on. Sit. Just do you trust me? Do you trust me? I hold up a mailed finger. it's a pinky finger. I say. Okay. All right. Look. Let's meet in the middle. You do your plan. I just want 10,000 bags of white powder, and just give me 5 or 6 of these Justin cocktails, all right? And then, and if my plan doesn't work, you could do your plan.
Okay, we're gonna do my plan, and then if my plan fails, then yours will be the backup plan.
Okay, but there has to be 10,000 white trash bags out in front of the castle,
to be white.
Okay, because anyway, they pop.
I point
visually.
Him out and I say, like, "Hey, did we just invent racism? All right, here we go."
Okay, great.
So I say, "Of course, the Duke will be heard." Give him literally 10. Let's then we move on with my plan to go preemptively attack the enemy.
By the way, my plan, Justin. Okay, all right. Okay. I realize nobody's gonna do it unless I do it, and so I go to the laundry room. And I'm like, your Duke commands you take all of this laundry, put it in white bags, stack them up 20 feet tall, all just the giantest stockpile of laundry you've ever seen right in front of the castle. And I grab my 10 bags of Justin cocktails and I walk out in the drawbridge and I just wait. I wait for the approaching army.
So one, we're confused to what a laundry room is, but we'll get past that. Second is what you have laundry.
Okay, look, no, I just want a lot of bags in front of this castle. I have a plan. I don't think Justin's going to be able to defeat us completely surrounded by marauding, even with superior technology. I do believe he'll be able to take out massive numbers of them, and I want to be there with my plan if that goes awry. It's called a bag.
Also, by the way, a flashback to 5 minutes ago when I made the joke about why do the bags have to be white. Edgar J. Racism scratched his head and goes, that gives me an idea. And walked out of the room. Anyway, back to the present.
So what's in the bags?
It doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. There's just lots of them, and I've got a few bags that really work.
Okay. All right.
Meanwhile, I'm marshaling our forces by giving a very stirring speech that, listen, I'm not going to be one of those medieval generals who's going to say, in a month, I'm going to go attack these forces. And then meanwhile, all the bad guys, they leave. They leave. How are we so stupid? How are we so stupid? We don't tell them. We go without telling them. We're not going to be one of those. We're going to tell them. Let's go right now.
Okay.
We go. Still
with
holding
our guns and our Justin cocktails, and march out in a surprise attack on the forces that are just now gathering to attack us.
All right, so you launch your first volley of Justin cocktails. Yeah. What do you call them? The explosions?
Jerry bombs. Happy parties.
cleansing flame.
Cleansing flames that go boom.
Yeah.
All right. So you launch your preemptive salvo. You go to the biggest, thickest part of the forces. You've started not just decimating, I'm literally just wiping out. Like you just caved in about a third of them. Like they're just caught off by surprise. The rest go running and screaming. The other ones start to marshal around and go sweep back around you and start approaching the castle from the rear.
Okay. I immediately say, move all the bags to the rear, and I walk around still holding.
Fortunately, it's an uphill climb for them, so you've got time to do that.
Good. Okay, so the bags are there, and I stand there waiting to see how the rest of Justin's military strategy plays out.
I'm like, yeah, chase him. Chase him down. Shoot him in the butt.
Yeah, so Justin's people are trying to chase them down, but you know these people are motivated by fear and we're moving pretty quickly. So now they're hoarding towards the castle where you're at, Brian.
Okay, so I turn and I say, somebody blow a horn, and make it like something that sounds like an entreaty, a peace accord.
Also, Edgar J. Horn says that gives me an idea. Walks out of the room.
And so I begin to march down the hill, holding up my bags of Justin cocktails for a peace agreement, and I stop and I say, send me an emissary, and I fling a Justin cocktail to show it explode, like in a vivid demonstration of our superior technology.
So the emissary is walking towards you and you throw it at him?
No, I throw it off to the side. This is, I didn't know he was coming. I say, I'm sorry. I didn't know you were already coming. I thought I needed to bedazzle you with my powers. But now that you're coming, come on up. And I promise I won't throw another.
All right. So he approaches you and he's, you know, about 5 feet away.
And I say, bring Justin, my trusted advisor, down. And I say...
And he's like, hey, you threw one. Why are you still holding both fists up in the air?
I say, because these are a gift to you. And I open up one and I show the powder inside. We will give to you the secrets of the Justin cocktail and these 10,000 bags behind you if you will give safe passage to me and my traveling companion, Justin, so that we may escape this land.
You sellout. You Sell out. What?
I say, but I say, we feel no allegiance to anyone in this castle. We feel like in many ways this is not where we belong. And we want to make use.
What are you doing? Of this. We're better than the Duke right now. You can reveal yourself to not be the Duke, and we would still be kings. We would rule this land. We can declare ourselves kings.
I lift up the mask. I say, also, I'm not the Duke. He's not here. We just handed you this land. All you have to do is conduct safe passage to us.
Where are we going?
Like, literally anywhere but where we'll be eventually figured out to be a frauds.
We just failed ourselves to be frauds, but we've just won a stunning, decisive military thing. Throw flame in this man's face, melt his skull, and say, hey, anybody else, you want to go ahead and put your name on some a surrender treaty? Because we're your new king.
So I turn back to him and I say, I suppose it's your choice then. Will you have a profitable domination of this land, or do you want to be destroyed at the hands of our superior technology?
I also turn around to everybody and I'm like, okay, again, so Brian's obviously not the Duke, but he is also very confused. We're 100% in on this whole castle thing. Like, we're way about it. In fact, the Duke sent for us knowing that he was on his dying breath. Well, sorry we had to have the subterfuge there.
I turn around and I say, your Duke was an asshat. He was a total D-bag who was killing people for his own. Also, he's dead upstairs. He died.
Okay, so we're going to go ahead and clarify that message a little bit and say, yay, castle, we are here for you. We are here to ensure your military dominance, unlimited prosperity.
I just sit down cross-legged and fold my arms over, and I say, well, anytime you guys want to decide, you just let me know.
Next time on Journey Quest.
Oh, my God. One warring, angry army wasn't enough for you. You had to have two.
No, we'll two have one. Entire groups. We're going to disappear. They don't know who we are. I don't know.
You're in the middle. Okay, I'm done.
For all we know, this is
an army with primitive versions of guns and Molotov cocktails, and now we want to immediately turn against them?
Well, no. We want to be rushed off. Maybe they can get us to Paris or something, and we can become, you know, I don't know, land barons or I don't know.
I got a feeling where we are, too.
This place sucks, by the way.
Well, okay. All right. Hey, picks, everybody. We all got picks. Who's got a pick? I got a pick. How about this one? It's a show on FX. It's called Legion. It's set in the FX or in the X-Men universe. It is probably the one of the more cinematic shows I think I've ever seen on television, in that it is very kind of esoteric, and I don't quite think I understand exactly what the hell's happening, but it is well made and super fun, and it's going to be one of those shows that will either always be visually amazing but incoherent, or it will continue to reveal itself to be a very, very rad genre story, which I'm always a big fan of. So Legion.
I'll go with 1 second after, the story of EMP destroying a small town and the rest of America. I just realized I just wanted to share a bunch of spoilers about what happens, but it's a story of what happens after EMPs take out technology.
My pick, I watched the first season this weekend, and that is the Starz show, Ash versus Evil Dead.
Oh, so good! So good!
Brian, have you seen it?
Yes. It's a lot of fun. I
would say the first couple episodes, they were fun, but it was certainly finding its pacing and finding out what it was going to be kind of a bit. And I would say that after like the third episode, it kind of got its groove and it knew what kind of show it was going to be. And have you watched season two yet?
I got halfway. I got caught up to real time and then decided to let my Starz subscription lapse. So I've got the last half of season two waiting for me.
It is a show that, like, you know, the, you know, Sam Raimi, Rob Tappert, Bruce Campbell, who, you know, did the original, you know, producers on this, Sam Raimi and Robert Tappert, who've gone on to do amazing, great things. It's a show that knows what made the Evil Dead movies so much fun. And then
you watch this and you're like, my God, this is just this. You could not see this in a movie theater. Some of the horrific stuff they do. The morgue scene from season two.
Yes. No, that was amazing. Like I tried. And by the way, it's very difficult to describe that kind of scene to someone out of context, because it does a great job of priming you to the over-the-top gore set pieces and where you're kind of twisting but laughing at the same time. It's when you describe it to Bonnie, it doesn't resonate. She's like, I'm glad you're watching it, not me.
This show is disgusting. It is over, and it says, hey, we think that, you know, the gore is a source of the humor because it's just so over-the-top. It's like, if you're in for a little, go in for a lot. And it goes excessive. I mean, it's just violent, violent, violent. You know, it's comedy, you know, horror. And it's like, yeah, we're just going to go all in on that. And there are scenes there that are disgusting that I'm going, oh, God. And there's a scene in the morgue that's just, go morgue. How gross can that be? I can't imagine anything grosser than what I saw.
I also
can't imagine anything grosser.
I also love the twisteroo of like, person missing a body part grew a new body part. And then it shows out, nope. Body part missing a person just grew a new person, and so great.
It is a fun show. Great, you know, see Bruce Campbell doing the Bruce Campbell thing, and the scenes with him are just wonderful. Ash is still Ash.
Well, I loved the casting of Buck Rogers as his dad. Was a lot of fun.
$6 million man.
Was it? Oh yeah, never mind. Whatever, one of them.
Lee Majors,
that's who it was. Yeah. Sorry. Good point. No, it was great.
Yeah. Well, I mean, who knows? You know, Gil Gerard could be his real father. Probably.
Yeah, maybe he finds out it was his fake dad.
Yeah, there's a great, like, son, something I have to tell you, and I won't tell you what happens next, but you get the show, you're like, I know. You're kind of like, you know what's going to happen, and you're just waiting for it. It's awesome. So, big fan. Justin, have you seen it?
I have not, no, but I'll be excited now that both of you have done it. It puts untold pressure on me to start getting in on it.
Don't forget, you get a free week of Stars if you have an Amazon subscription. Just go and search for Ash versus Evil Dead. It'll say, hey, you could pay for this episode or get a week of Stars free and watch all of them. And then hopefully you won't forget and find yourself signed up for Stars, and it won't be for something silly like what was it you watched to get Bryce?
Like Paul Blart Mall Cop 2.
Paul Blart Mall Cop 2. did you have a pick, Bryce?
I do. I normally don't have a pick, but I had a chance to play something really cool last night, and I think it fits really well for the show. Are you guys familiar at all with like not text adventure games, but there are these mobile phone games where a story takes place kind of in real time, and you get. Like you say, oh, go do this, and then they'll be like, okay, and then they go away for an hour, and then you get a little text when they come back. Like this is a new genre of text storytelling.
You're talking about when you say text, you mean like SMS texts?
Well, they're all in an app and push notifications and stuff. So, but it comes in like a text or a text message,
right?
But
your interaction is with other characters purely through what feels like an SMS or chat like experience.
Yeah. And there are a couple of them. A lot of them are like sci-fi, and some of them are like romancy ones. And generally, they're all really, really horrible. But I was reminded a lot about them from a game that I played that is, I feel, almost the opposite of those games. I think those are all pretty bad because they are fighting themselves to just tell you a good story. It's a game on Steam called Killing Time at Light Speed. And it's a very short game. It's like $10. It's only about a half hour. But I think you can actually play it more than once to kind of get different outcomes. But the idea is that you are on a ship. You've just boarded a ship to go off-world, outer planetary. Space travel is a thing, and people are colonizing different planets, and people are leaving Earth to go and find opportunities. And you are on this ride. It's like a, you know, they say, oh, this is going to be a 30-minute ride. But because of the way that the space travel mechanism doodad works is that there is a time difference between what you are experiencing and what Earth experiences. So what they say, when you start at the thing is, your space travel will take about a half hour, but in Earth, on Earth, time will advance forward 29 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as a part of that, we have worked a deal with, this thing that's not called Facebook, but it's like Facebook, where you can check on, you know, your social media feeds during this trip. And so the idea is that you are constantly checking in with your loved ones on social media at a hyper accelerated pace.
Oh, that's amazing.
It's really cool, and it's a nice little thing. And I feel like I would probably go and play it again because it seems like there is actually a lot of choices that you can make. I think it's really cool. And, you know, it's kind of a weird value proposition for such a short game for $10. But I think it's really well made. There's a lot of text to read and a lot of interesting personalities that you kind of get to experience.
Andrew, it reminds me of Haldeman's The Forever War. Did you ever read mm-hmm. that? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah, we're like in kind of like the fourth trip into there. We're like, what's normal? You know, like he comes back for the you know, the premise in Forever War is that, you know, we're fighting this intergalactic war, fighting this war and sending people out, you know, at near light speed, and they come back, their soldiers come back, and 20 years goes by, 30 years goes by, or 100 years. And so society changes so much. And it was kind of a parable for Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he comes back at one point, and the fact that he's straight is weird because everybody else is gay.
Yeah.
Like, oh, wow. Whatever, breeder, weirdo.
Yeah.
Well, there are interesting things there, too. And it actually left me like I felt pretty weird at the end of it, because the way that it ends is very I won't spoil it, but the ending is caught me by surprise and I was not surprised by it at all. So I think it's pretty cool. Killing Time cool. at light speed.
Awesome.
Nice.
Excellent. It's been weird.
Damn right.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.